This week on Snark Squad Pod, we are joined by Sylvia Roma to discuss the 2018 Netflix miniseries Maniac. Welcome back to Snark Squad Pod. I am your host, Nicole Sweeney, and I am joined as always by my co-host.
My name is Marines.
And of course, our wonderful guest this week is Sylvia. Say hello and introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Sylvia. I like television. And this is me talking with my pals about television.
I guess you don't have stuff to plug. This is usually where that happens. Yeah, but I'm, friendship.
I just like to talk. So, a plug that I talk sometimes.
Great.
Sylvia's joined us to talk about Maniac today. And Maniac is, it was actually, from when we're recording this, it was released 2 days ago. So we all binged 10 episodes over the last 2 days. Go us. But it is a limited run series on Netflix. Like, I think it's just going to be the single season. And it is about two of our main characters, Owen and Annie, who are each dealing with their own issues, for lack of a better word. So Owen is currently going through some family problems right at the beginning. His big brother has been accused of sexual assault, and his family is pressuring him to testify, give his big brother an alibi, basically. And Owen is obviously feeling very conflicted about this. He's also being put in a position where he has to be cross-examined. And through this, we find out that he's also been diagnosed as schizophrenic. On the other hand, Annie is, I don't know what Annie's doing at the beginning of this, but that's probably the best description for Annie. I don't think Annie knows what she's doing at the beginning of the series. She's still dealing with the loss of her sister. We're not entirely sure right at the beginning what's going on, but she's either lost or she's not near or around her sister. And we later find out that her sister has died. They both end up signing up for this drug trial. It's for money, but also Annie signs up because she's illegally gotten like the drug that they're trialing through a friend, and she's become addicted to the drug. And so she figures after she runs out, she figures she can join the drug trial, and that'll be the best way for her to get more. Owen is mostly in it for the money, I would say. But the whole purpose of the drug trial is also that it's like supposed to replace therapy. So the whole promise is that it will kind of fix your brain. So because both of them are dealing with their own diagnosis and traumas and whatnot, I feel like that was another big pull for both of them. So they go into this drug trial, and it's really trippy. And basically, it's a series of drugs, of medicines that they have to take that send them into these, like, I don't know, dreams, visions. It's very weird.
Experiences, but I think is what they call them.
Yeah. And it's supposed to, at first, kind of confront them with their trauma, and then sort of like map out their brain, any blind spots in the brain, just kind of make a big picture of their brain. And then they have to confront all of this. So those is kind of the stages that they have to go through. But we see that Owen and Annie end up in each other's experiences, which is not something that's supposed to happen, but every time they go on an experience, they end up back together. And that kind of highlights for the people who are running the drug trial that something is wrong with the computer. And then that sends us into another spiral about the computer was actually given emotions, and she's depressed because the main doctor who was running the trial also died at the beginning of the series. So we've got a depressed computer and two main characters who are dealing with their own traumas, and they all kind of end up in each other's brain spaces. And then at the very end, they complete the trial, even though the computer goes haywire for a little bit. But they complete the whole drug trial, and it has a surprisingly straight and heartfelt ending in which these two people just become friends, and, you know, they break him out of, he was committed, and they break him out. I skipped a bunch.
Yeah,
I mean, skipped a bunch.
A lot of weird shit happens in the middle, but that's the heart of it.
Cool.
So we're going to start where we always start. Baseline for everybody. Did you like this, Sylvia?
This was wild. I still, like, I think yes. Like, that's the thing about this is I feel like I need to watch it again slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in fact, like just before we were, while I was eating my Taco Bell lunch, I was rewatching episode 3, which is the episode where they have them after they've finished taking the A pill and they're doing those like intake interviews or post intake interviews. And so I just like, I want to take more time to digest it because I think I did like it. There are things that were very funny, things that were very sad, things that were super weird.
Uh-huh.
But I also am just still kind of like wrapping my head. I really like wrapping my head around some of the moments.
Yeah.
So my baseline gut instinct is I think yes, but this was wild.
Yeah. That's a fair reaction.
The first thing that I tweeted about this, because I started watching it, it was like 20 minutes in and I just had to tell Twitter that I had no idea what was going on. And that feeling kind of lasted maybe through the first episode. But I think by episode 2, when things started to really come together, I realized that I was loving this. I really, really had a good time watching this, which is kind of weird to say because it's dark and it has a lot to do with like trauma and grief and mental health. But it becomes a very weird experience to watch media for this podcast. And I know we're talking about this all of the time, but it is super trippy, which is kind of a good word to use overall for this episode. But I enjoy the things that I watch, but it also becomes kind of homeworky after a while when you're doing like one week after the other. And not to say that I dislike it. Obviously, I love this podcast, but this was something that I sat down to watch and it didn't feel at all like homework. I was enjoying the entire thing. I probably would have binged it anyways, regardless of this podcast. Like, it was just something that I wanted to consume that way. I thought that it was weird, but I loved it. I thought it was earnest in places, and I really loved a lot of what it was saying about these two people and kind of their traumas and all of that. So yeah, I was an A+, really enjoyed it.
I also really enjoyed this. It is definitely not without its problems, but they are problems that I am very much inclined to overlook. Like, just the strengths of this show are things that are so right in my wheelhouse. It's, first of all, it is just like such an aesthetic journey, which is a thing that's come up. A thing that I have learned this year while we've been making this podcast is that I am a total sucker for that. Like, that is something that I can overlook a lot of things if I find something interesting enough in the aesthetic quality of what I'm looking at, you know, which whatever that is, whatever that says about me. We were recently having a conversation in the Snark Squad Discord, which you should all join, about how working on this podcast has taught me that I really wish that I had a stronger grasp of like cinema language, because I think I have a lot of sort of feelings about cinematography that I don't actually know how to articulate, just based on like things that I don't know, observed preferences that I have noticed this past year in particular. So there's that. The show is like very trippy and weird. Occasionally it's like weird for weirdness's sake in ways that I could see being off-putting for people, but I was totally like here for. I bought into it. And I don't know, like the way that it straddles that line between just being weird and also earnest, how it bounces back and forth between those things was something that I personally very much enjoyed. And so I loved this, but I can also see, I have a feeling that it'll be kind of polarizing. Like, I think that people will love it or hate it. And like, I think that people who hate it will hate a lot of the very things that I love about it, if that makes sense.
I totally agree about like kind of that polarizing detail. I think there are a few things here that like if it misses with you, this is just as an experience is not going to be great for you.
Right.
And it's always weird to say like people love it or hate it. Like, yeah, that's true about all media. But this in particular just feels like polarizing. Like there won't be a lot of middle ground. And I feel like if you don't buy into like the emotional beats of what the story is trying to tell you, the really weird stuff is not going to be enough to sell it. It'll feel more weird for weird's sake than like, I don't know, sitting down and being like, yeah, man, my brain's messed up too. Like, I don't know, like having that like emotional baseline of like, okay, I kind of get what the story is telling me.
Yeah, I mean, I was sold on definitely seeing it all the way through. Because, of course, as soon as I finished, I went through and read some, like, tweets just to gauge what other people's general reactions were.
Uh-huh.
And there were a bunch of them that were like, I made it, I gave it three episodes, and I can't continue. And I can see why that would potentially happen, because those first two episodes are the exact same time frame, but from two different perspectives. And so sometimes I was curious if that was going to be how the whole 10 episodes was. I was like, is this how we're going to do this? And it wasn't. So that was good. but I did enjoy that for those two episodes, to kind of get to know our two main characters at their core. But what like really sold the whole thing for me, and I texted Nicole this, like, as soon as we start, like, I started watching, I was like, I'm stuck on Spaceship Earth. Like, this entire film, so if you've ever been on Spaceship Earth in Epcot, the very, 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 very end of it, as you're coming out, it's like this, like, futuristic scene where they're doing, like science and go-go boots, and it's, like, the way that Walt Disney envisioned, you know, science, but, like, of the future, but of the 80s. And that is 100% what the entire aesthetic of this this miniseries was for me. I truly felt like I was experiencing what was happening in that end scene of Spaceship Earth. Like, that is where I was. This whole film was for me that, and I was, or not film, like, it feels like, it felt like a film to me.
Totally.
But the whole series felt like that for me. I was like, yes, I'm in the retro future of today.
Right off the bat, you get that very disjointed, like, this is situated in some sort of other timeline, right? Like, it's like that there's the aesthetic is very retro, but then there's like some futuristic components to it. Like, it is otherworldly. And I had this thought almost immediately after, like, when it first starts, and we get the first, it's that little video from Justin Theroux's doctor sort of like talking about what consciousness is. And it's like partially sort of self-serious, but it's also very, like, you know, jokey. And you're like, okay, this is like a very interesting tone setting. And then we segue into like the like Russian tour guide and the Statue of Extra Liberty and all of that. And it reminded me of something from Crash Course Film, and I don't know if this is a Tobin Addington thing or a Nick Jenkins thing, one of the two of them, who have both been guests on this podcast before, but the first few minutes of a film teach you how to watch it. And I like the first few minutes of this show, like to me, people who dropped out early, honestly, I'm like, you probably made the right call. Like, if you didn't enjoy the first episode of this show, it goes in other directions. I think there's a lot more to it. But I feel like if you watched that first episode and you were like, this is not for me, like, you probably made the right call. Like, honestly, I think you can tell in the first 5 minutes. I feel like there were so many things about, like, tonally that were established in the first 5 minutes that, like, either you're in it or you're not. Like, very clearly.
The whole, like, retro future of today, which is, like, amazing and describes this whole thing perfectly.
Beautifully.
Right. It really, what I picked up from it was that it was a really great way to throw you off balance. Yes. I think that was just such a smart tool to use, to be like, okay, everything you know, like, throw it out the window kind of thing, because you couldn't even anchor yourself in time. Like, I was like, where are we? When are we? Like, there was no sort of anchor. But like you said, immediately that kind of tells you what the whole experience is going to be. You couldn't really rely on your, like, known ideas in order to get you through this, because it was just kind of constantly playing with that. So I really appreciated that, even though there was every so often I would just, like, notice something else, like their glasses, for instance, the scientist, Azumi, I think is her name.
Yeah.
And Justin Theroux's, every time I noticed their glasses, I was like, ugh, when are we? It's like a constant. But yes, I thought it was a really great tone setting device.
Yeah, and I will say the only thing that for me, where I was able to do some time placement, at least for the current time, and then the other one, and this is probably because I am from the state of New York, was the license plates. and so I have such a vivid memory of that white license plate with the Statue of Liberty, with the red Statue of Liberty, because that's the license plate from when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And so that series of when in they're on the B-pill and they are Linda and
Yes.
That takes place for sure in like
in the 80s.
Early 90s. Like 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Because those are the license plates of my childhood.
I can imagine you watching this and being like, I got one, 80s.
Yeah, I got this one. And I'm pretty sure I saw the yellow license plates that are of now in the like the current time, like the where they are in real life. Real, what is even real life in this thing?
Yeah.
But I think that it's set in current day, but
yeah, I mean, I would argue that like it's that seems more or less true. Justin Theroux's character, they say at one point in time that he was born in 1977.
Yep.
So like, you know, that's, I don't know how old exactly he is. I'm sure I could look it up, but I would guess the actor was born in the 70s as well. So like, yeah, roughly now, but like clearly in some sort of alternate timeline of roughly now.
It felt like, yeah, like the alternate timeline where like people continued to use tapes and didn't move to CDs.
And floppy disks.
And floppy disks. Because like they're still like printing shit out and pressing buttons. It was out of an Epcot.
Bizarre.
Oh, yeah. The floppy disk, the little like piece of paper that said Jane Derriere. There are lots of really cool and weird. That's one of the other reasons why I want to go back and watch it, because there were lots of really, really cool, like little things in just the, like when you were looking. So like the Jane Derriere one, I only caught because someone else had posted it. And I was like, that's very funny. It was one of the porn, like cassette tape things from when, Azumi goes to pick up, James. Is that his name? The new doctor.
Yeah, the doctor, yeah.
And that's one of the names of like the porn tapes that he is like playing. And it's weird because they're like floppy disks, but then they're also AR.
Right.
It's so cool.
I love it. There are a lot of interesting little visual gags like that too. Yes. I also would like to, Sally Field, when we first see her, so she first appears in the Dreamscape, but the first time that her real life character appears, we cut to her apartment and we see her books, and like one of her book titles is I'm Okay, You're a Bitch.
Yep.
Which I was like, great. I can't wait to meet you. I'm excited. But speaking of Sally Field, I don't know that we've talked about it much explicitly on the podcast, or if this is just something that we've talked about, like, I don't know, offline, but one of the things that we run into with like big casts is that when talking about how good all the performances are, it's, you run the risk of just like rattling off a list of names of like, that guy's great. And then that guy's great. And everyone's great, which I 100%, this is a show with which I could do that. I kept writing down, doing the thing where I was like writing down names, and then I, looking at my notes now, I'm like, well, I can't just sit here.
I can just list the entire cast.
Right. You can go to IMDb, see them all. They're all great.
Let's just roll the end credits now.
Right. But I think that that's, you know, like maybe a good place to start, though, is with sort of our main characters. And I don't know how you guys felt about Annie and Owen.
I, at one point, Nicole and I were also texting about this. I think because I was very surprised to like this. I didn't know what I was expecting. The trailers were all very cryptic, so it didn't show a lot of information. I went into it not really knowing what I was expecting. And we kind of just picked this out like, oh, this is coming out on Netflix, you know, in September. Let's do that one. That
on
was
a
literally
where we don't have any.
Right.
We talk about that weekend.
Oh, here's the thing. That's literally how we picked this. So I had no like strong feelings going in. So I was very surprised to be enjoying it as much as I did. So I was texting Nicole about this. And I think one thing that I told her, you know, just, that Jonah Hill was breaking my heart with his facial expressions.
Yeah.
And at the very end, Annie describes him to a different character as, oh, like the friend buddy or the whatever, the friend stand-in. They have all these really weird like details to the world too. So she like hires a friend basically who's supposed
friend
to be
proxy.
Owen. Friend proxy. Who's supposed to be Owen, but he's not doing it right. And she's like, no, he's got like this sadness, but underneath is like this care and concern. And I was like, that's perfectly him. That's like, that's exactly how he played it the whole time. Just like that, like, do deep, like from his pores, sadness, but also just a lovingness and, you know, a loyalty and a caring. And I think that Jonah did a surprisingly good job. And that's probably just me. I don't know why it was surprising. I'd never seen him in anything like this. I was just like, man, oh, every time he looks at the camera, I want to cry. So I think he did a great job.
I also really enjoyed his performance. I am such a sucker for Emma Stone. Like, same. I just, it's her big eyes and her, like, beautiful face and her, like, sultry sounding kind of raspy voice. And mm-hmm. I am here for literally every second of it. Like, I could, like, have her, like, just read the alphabet over and over and over again and be like, yeah, okay, cool. Like, I go to the alphabet now, you know? And I think that the two of them had what was surprising to me was not like their individual performances, but how their chemistry was for me, that it was so tender and like so loving in this way that it never came off to me in any way as romantic, but that chemistry was so beautifully intense. Mm-hmm. And really intimate. It felt really, really intimate in those spaces. Like, there were times when I really felt like I was, am I allowed to be here right now?
Like, yeah. Just having like a private moment.
In your brains. Can I be here too?
Yeah. And I know that probably, you know, same thing, like, don't have the words to grasp or, you know, the vocabulary to grasp the emotion that it feels. It felt like the way that they were filming this and the way that they were scoring it, particularly, it elicited that emotion in me. Like, their performances joined with the way that how visually stunning this is made me be like, am I allowed? Is it okay?
I think Emma Stone, and I maybe I'm biased because of my I just went into this with more goodwill towards her and Sonoya, gosh, I forgot her last name now, but she, Araminta Lee from Crazy Rich Asians, the two of them were kind of the two that I was like, the two actors that I was, you know, oh yes, they're in this thing, cool, that sounds promising, whatever. But Emma Stone I think did a better job with the diversity of stuff that they were asked to do. Mm-hmm. I think she slipped into the various roles a little bit better up until, much to my surprise, the Icelandic guy up at the end. That was the first time that I was like, oh, okay, Jonah Hill is really leaning into this bizarre character. I'm not really sure what you're doing, but I approve of it and I'm into it. But I really enjoyed watching them slip into all of the different characters and watching them get to do all of these different things, which, I don't know, goes back to the ways in which I think the show is ultimately going to be hit or miss. There are lots of just deeply meta things going on in Alien. The way the story is being told that I'm super into. But both of their performances I thought were great, and I was rooting for him the whole time.
My point, where I agree that Emma Stone did a better job doing all of the variety of characters, and she did a better, like, because yes, Jonah Hill's, like, his character was just constantly like sad, but sad as this guy, like sad as this guy. You're like, okay. Emma had like more range and a variety as she was
asked to have more range. Yeah, right. That's yes, in fairness.
But the one where I was like, oh, okay, well, and granted, yes, the Icelandic guy was more of a departure, but the one that really got me was when he was like the mafioso with like the face and neck tattoos. Yeah. Something about that performance, I was like, oh man, you're killing it. Like, I'm totally buying like your braids and your like grill right now.
Yes, good. Since I mentioned that, you know, I my notes are a list of random names, I was really excited, though, that two people from the Americans have parts in this of varying size. But the guy who is who Emma Stone buys cigarettes from at the very beginning is like head of the he's head of like the Russian embassy in the Americans. And then he reappears in that UN scene at the end as like the Russian ambassador, which I really appreciated. Just, I don't know, like as like a personal, I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, there you are again, speaking Russian. Beautiful, perfect. I love it. But also her younger sister is yes. Julia Garner, who also was like phenomenal and really, really cool and exciting to get to see her doing something else. And she also had a couple different things that she was tasked with over the course of this series and its many bizarre little journeys, and did them all just beautifully.
We're going to talk about sibling feels, but just to tack on another name in our list of credits here.
Yep.
Hank Azaria just shows up at the end. It was like, okay, you're here for 10 minutes. Like, that's cool. I don't know why that casting was like a shock, and just seeing him, I was like, okay, this is another like bizarre thing in this entire bizarre. At that point, you had seen so many weird things. I don't know why Hank Azaria is like her father. I was like, what? But...
And it just like pops out of the window.
Yeah. I'm here. And one of my favorite tropes too is like somebody's like addressing or talking, thinks they're talking to someone, yep. but they're not really there. It's like one of my favorite tropes. So when I saw him pop in the window, I was like, ah, oh, great trope. And Hank Azaria.
I'm into it. Okay, so sibling feels. You mentioned it. Let's get into it.
So I kind of glossed over this in my synopsis. So what ends up happening is that Emma Stone, gosh, Annie's little sister, is moving away from New York at kind of the big moment that changes her life. And I guess Annie is going with her like on this cross-country trip, but she's being kind of a jerk the entire time. Mm-hmm. And they end up arguing, they have a big fight, and we watch this all go down, and when she's on the A-pill and she's kind of reliving her most traumatic moment. And so they have a huge fight, but they end up kind of going the next day and driving even more, but they start, it feels like almost like they've reconciled a little bit, but then, you know, Annie's a jerk again. And as they're kind of arguing about this, and it's all over, well, not really all over, but it kind of manifests over this like little disposable camera that Annie is refusing to take normal pictures with. Mm-hmm. And so as they're kind of pulling them back and forth, there is a truck driving on the wrong side and there's a head-on collision, and the little sister dies in this crash. So it's a very traumatic moment, obviously, for Annie. But then we also get to, through being in Annie's head, we get to relive a lot of their relationship and their very fraught relationship with their mother and their family and their growing up experience. So sibling feels galore here for me. I don't know if it was something that stood out to you guys, but I immediately wrote down like sibling feels, because it was just part, I think this was a part of the story that maybe affected me the most. It was just very, very, very gut-wrenching to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think her backstory was probably, or her, you know, trauma, whatever, her mental struggles were probably explored a little bit more. I don't know. They were given a little bit more narrative weight, particularly at the end, because we sort of stop grappling. We grapple with Owen's schizophrenia at the beginning, but it kind of fades away as a plot thread, or at least it doesn't have the same weight that it does at the beginning by the end. Whereas the sibling, like that dynamic, takes on increasing weight as the story progresses. And the story spends a lot of time, not just with her, but with a number of characters kind of grappling with grief and how different people deal with it. And heavy on the sibling feels. I also thought it was just really interesting that just the whole premise of her character is the idea that somebody could be addicted to the worst day of their life. Like that's what her character is. That's you know, her addiction to this drug, whatever. That's ultimately what's happening, that, you know, that it's, she's her not moving on, you know, whatever, that she's trapped in that day. And I thought that was just an interesting kind of narrative device to use. And I think as weird and trippy as this show is, ultimately at its core, a lot of what it's saying ends up being kind of simple, like that, you know, that's, it's, she's grieving and she cannot you know, she doesn't want to move on because she doesn't want to accept what's happened, et cetera, et cetera. And then whatnot. But I enjoyed framing it in taking that fairly simple idea and dressing it up in the bizarre trappings of this world.
I think a lot of what this story is saying, too, is about stories. And I forget the line specifically, but Owen has a line about how, you know, our lives are kind of these stories that we tell ourselves mm-hmm. and the things that we remember. And that as a theme is like, you know, chef's kiss for me. I love it so much yeah. about how we frame our memories and our stories. And I think a big part of what Annie, you know, when it comes down to it and you finally hear her reasoning for why she was being such a jerk to her little sister and she wouldn't take the picture. She was just upset that her little sister was moving away and they wouldn't see each other anymore. And she says, nobody else knows my stories. Like nobody right. else shares these things with me. And she was just very sad in a way that it's something that I've thought a lot about too, about how you just grow apart from people and how your paths, you know, take you different places and your stories diverge. And so her very real fear of that, of their stories diverging and of like nobody knowing her on this fundamental level, like that, I mm-hmm. think was just, that was what really, really got me. I was like, oh no. Like, I get all of, yeah, you had me with the trippy, but now you're getting me with the real feels. Like, I don't know. And that was very interesting, like to have as like one of their fundamental problems or what, you know, Annie was trying to hold on to in a story that was all about stories, you know, framed yes. in this way.
Yes.
I think for me, I had, you know, I have a sibling. He's cool.
good.
I love him very much. But I connected this more in thinking about family and the ways mm-hmm. that people and families experience and process and work through grief. And maybe that's because I've not lost a sibling, but I have lost a family member of the same age as me in a really, really traumatic way mm-hmm. and in a surprising way that, you know, none of us were prepared for. And so watching this, I felt a lot of that. Like, I can understand wanting to live through your last day with someone over and over and over again because it's the only time that you can know, like have a conversation again. I can understand, you know, wanting to even see that person or like spend time with that person. And even though it's so incredibly painful, that joy of getting to see that person again is outweighs the grief in that sense. But what happens is then you can't actually exit that grief cycle and move on and move forward because all you're doing is continuing to relive your trauma. And so for me, watching this, I really, really like connected with the way that she was kind of re-traumatizing herself mm-hmm, mm-hmm. over and over and over and over just to feel like a second of joy, mm-hmm. which is so sad.
Yeah.
But I really, really thought that they captured that so well. And you see this like really, really close and intense connection. And then to counter that, you see Owen, who's like making up a sibling who doesn't exist.
Right.
Because he's never had that kind of familial connection with his own family. And so here's someone craving connection in a completely different way by creating something that they didn't know that they were missing. And someone missing, I don't know, the whole thing.
Yeah.
There's just
yeah.
so much.
Yes.
There's just so much there. And I thought that felt so powerful to me. And it was captured, so many of these like emotions were just captured so beautifully.
There was definitely like a piece, I love what you said about like her wanting to relive it because it was, you know, seeing that person again. Mm-hmm. I think there was also an aspect of guilt there. It was almost mm-hmm. like yes. she was punishing herself in a lot of ways, you know, by reliving this. But, you know, she didn't want to exit the grief cycle because then it would be over. So right. like the finality of that, I think she was also like, you know, she was holding on for a reason. She was holding on, even if it was the worst day of her life, she was still holding on to her sister in that day. So the entire thing, when we found out that what the drug did, because we see her like taking the drug, snorting right. it, and then I noted, like, I was like, well, nothing happened. She just went to sleep kind of yeah. thing. That's like, yeah, I was like, what kind of drug is this? Uh-huh. And then when you find out that it's been causing her to relive that day over and over again, I mean, yeah, sucker punch to the feels.
Yes, very much so. I, on a different note, but about this being a story about storytelling, I died a little when in the fantasy dream sequence, which was a thing of fucking beauty.
Yes. Just
every minute that we spent in that was fantastic. In particular, once Annie sort of comes to in that sequence from like that point, I loved the way that they kind of grappled with that, her like realizing, oh, you love this, like I hate this, okay, I get what's going on here, that kind of a component of it. But when Annie and her sister, when her sister, she's trying to tell her sister what's going on, and her sister's like you realize that this sounds ridiculous, that you're telling me that there's this other world, whatever. And her sister starts naming, she's like, that I'm not real, we're not really here, and neither is every person, elf, dwarf, orc. And Annie's like, oh my fucking god, don't list them. And I was like, it's me reading fantasy, this is it. I relate to you so deeply right now. I loved it.
All of those experiences, I think, did a really good job just calling to whatever like genre that they were based on.
Yes.
I think that was part of the fun of it too. Like as soon as they, her as like a drunk half elf was just like, I just loved it so much. There were so, like you said, like meta jokes and call-ins, you know, about the different genres that they were exploring in these experiences.
They threw a press conference for an alien. I love that in the same, you know, 10 episode span, we had this like amazing, beautiful, like fantasy sequence. And then also this like bizarre Norway, Icelandic, like sci-fi alien moment where and like, a blue alien that you never even see, they're like throwing a press conference for him, and then he blows up and everyone's just full of blue goop. And I was like, this is a late, like I was laughing so hard in that the whole thing to me was just, it was so outrageous, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. so fucking funny. I was like, this is hilarious.
So you bringing up how much you laughed before we started recording, Lori sent me a message on Discord. I'm pulling it out to look at it. This is billed as a dark comedy, but I don't know. Do you find it funny? So I found it fucking hilarious. In particular, Sally Field's character was consistently like belly mm-hmm. laughs. She was amazing. I just at every turn, especially in her introduction, was fantastic. Also, Owen screaming, "I'm a hawk," while being yes. a hawk.
the voiceover.
There were just so many like bizarre, the comedic moments, I think, are in a lot of ways like the glue that hold this sort of weird thing together. You know, like you have the kind of endearing heart, and then it does like the weird trippy thing. And as it vacillates back and forth between those things, it's like the comedy, I think, that helps keep those things together. Like, but I found this hilarious.
Like, and friend proxy Owen thinking, oh yeah, the appropriate thing now is to propose.
And I'm then finding just, it a lot funnier in retrospect. Like, I'm laughing with you guys now.
And then I did, I had moments where I laughed just from like, you know, certain names come up, so like Wendy the lemur, and then having the patient's name that they were visiting be Wendy Lemurna, and so how that's why, you know, that name existed or why it happened in this weird way. Mm-hmm. And those things are always really fun to catch.
Yeah.
But I also was like, oh, okay, this is bizarre, but I'm chuckling now. Linda and Mike, maybe, was his name in that one. I'm not sure. Mariano, if you will. And I was just like, oh God, so many weird, bizarre, funny things. Cause I also don't know that I was like laughing, like full belly laugh any time, but like chuckling or giggling or being like, oh, this is funny.
Yeah.
When he was like, when he had the grills and the face tattoos or whatever, and he ended up marrying that like waitress and they ended up with 7 kids and they're yelling their names, Antarctica, Africa. Like, I was like, why? Why is this happening?
It was great. I loved it. So yeah, I don't know. I thought it was hilarious personally, but you know, maybe if you go back and rewatch it, you will find many laughs.
Yeah. I think I was more focused. A lot of what I'm laughing at now were the moments that I was sitting there thinking, why are they doing this? So maybe my brain wasn't registering it as like, ha ha ha. Cause I was like in like mystery figuring out mode or whatever. Mm. But, yeah, now that we're like naming them all, I'm like, this was really funny. So I just missed the humor the first time around, I guess.
It's funny, but like verging on like absurd. And so you're just like,
we haven't really talked about Sally Field as a depressed computer. So, which seems, you know, like, you know, we can't record the whole episode of this podcast without discussing Sally Field as a depressed computer. Like, that seems like a major thing to leave out of a podcast episode. I don't know. I don't know if there's really anything more to say than just to make sure that everyone's clear that Sally Field plays a depressed computer
like
on this
brilliantly
show. And if that
depressed.
Sounds like something you're into, watch it. If it doesn't, you're right. It's not for you.
I think that you mentioned about how like this whole thing was kind of in your wheelhouse. And I think one of the things that I was like, oh my gosh, this is so for me, was when we realized that the computer's depressed because Azumi basically gave it feelings in an attempt to like have the computer protect the subjects in the trial.
Uh-huh.
And anytime there's a story about like giving feelings to AI, I'm like, yes, explore it. Let's listen.
What does it mean?
Right. And I love that here, like, I mean, it usually ends up with this like whole thing of like, you know, feelings kind of suck. It complicates a lot of things.
And so to have feelings are hard.
Right. And to have the computer kind of lose one of the doctors who was running the trial and then be really upset about that and like that have a rippling effect for everybody in the trial. I thought that was really, I don't know, it's just funny and sweet and earnest all at the same time. But and then Sally Field is amazing and she gives a great performance both as a mom and as a depressed computer. So I thought that was just really, really neat. And again, in a story that is a lot about like trauma and grief and feelings, having her, you know, messing this up and kind of, you know, messing with each of them and their stories, I thought was a really neat way to bridge all of it. Even though, you know, it is still very trippy, a depressed computer, it was a nice like bridge, a nice anchor in the story.
It's very on the nose repeatedly. Like
right.
Her character is there to every time, almost every line from the depressed computer is very, what we're doing right now is this. Like
right.
This is the larger like resonance of what we're trying to say. And again, and that is the kind of thing that for some people is going to take you out of it and like make you not like it. But I enjoyed it. I was here for it.
I can see people thinking that this is like landing on the side of thinking that this wasn't weird enough because of that. Because it is. There are a lot of things that happened that I was like, I don't understand why. And that's fine. But I think a lot of it was talked through because of the computer, but also because this is like a drug trial and they're talking a lot about therapy and mental health. So a lot of times they literally sit the person down and are like, how are you feeling? What did you experience? Like, how do you think this relates to your mother? Like, very leading questions. So it is very, very on the nose at times. And so I think that, you know, there might be people who don't want their weird so over-explained, but I thought it really worked for me.
One of the things that made me laugh the hardest was Sally Field being her own self-image's therapist.
Yes.
The entire scene where here's Sally Field playing almost like a child, like a computer that has become a petulant child who is lonely and wants friends and doesn't know how to be sad yet, but knows that she needs people. Mm-hmm. And then imagine try to be your own therapist.
It's just wild. And
it
so
goes as
funny.
Well as you think it would, basically.
Oh, it's so good.
I think that's the other thing too. Reasons that this totally did land for me though is the fact that it is exploring therapy and mental health stuff. Like those are things that I am interested in seeing in my media in general. Like I want more explorations of just like complicated, messy mental health where we call it what it is rather than just like, I don't know, this character is just tortured and troubled and whatever. This is a character who's dealing with some mental health shit, and we're going to talk about mental health shit, and that's what this whole fucking thing is going to be. Also, there's elves.
Drunk elves. Yes.
A lot of gimlets.
A lot of gimlets.
The drink of choice of fancy people everywhere.
The other moment was like when she's like, do you want a gimlet? And he's like, what's that? And she's like,
A gimlet.
Which it totally like works with the fact that these are all sort of dreams, right? So that's like in one of their heads is, yes, fancy people drink gimlets. Do I fucking know what a gimlet is? No. But fancy people drink them. So that's great.
I think that that's why the end like worked really well for me too, because they were talking about a lot of mental health things. So to have them sit down at the end and for Annie to say to Owen, like, you know, maybe your brain is a little messed up, but you're going to take medication. You're going to be fine. And I'm going to be there for you as a friend. And for him to say, sometimes I'm going to mess up, and her to be like, I'll still be there. Like that whole wrap up of things of just like, I don't know, normalizing it a little bit at the very end. I thought that was just and to have the entire like last episode, the 10th episode is really straight. Like you come out of the experiences, they're out of the drug trial. So it's just like a nice little like normal bow on an otherwise like very trippy experience, which I really appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the hawk on the little sanitation machine at the end.
Right, except for that.
Don't forget, we're still weird.
Still the same weird show you've been watching. Don't worry.
Like, don't worry. Please. Fear not.
I also wrote down, when they introduce Owen, his last name is Milgram, but I thought Milgram, so like the Milgram experiments,
that's the prisoner's dilemma. That's the one where they are shocking the patient. Yes, the doctor shocks the patient.
Yes, correct.
And there's an actor usually there.
Yeah. So the way the setup of this experiment is, this is like a very famous, like if you've ever taken like psych or sociology 101, you know about this experiment. But just in case you have not heard about this, that's the premise is you have there's three people. There's a researcher overseeing an experiment where one person is administering shocks to another person when the other person like does something wrong. But the only person being observed here is actually the person administering the shocks, and the person receiving the shocks isn't actually receiving them. They're an actor, and it's like to test. Generally speaking, it's like discussed in terms of because you have the authority figure of like the researcher, the person, the test subject will keep administering the shocks even though they're hurting the other person. Anyway, so that's the Milgram experiment. His last name is actually Milgram, not Milgram, and that's, I don't know, I-M-A-M. So I'm not really sure if there was something there, but that like the fact that we introduce immediately that his last name is like so similar to this very, very famous psychological experiment on this, in this show that is all about brain stuff, was like an interesting twist. And I don't know that it really went anywhere. I don't have any like really lucid thoughts about whether or not that was like an actual thing or just some like a red herring, which would also, be well within bounds for this show to do. But that was something that I thought was really interesting.
I think to me it was a purposeful on the nose kind of thing again, just because Owen's entire storyline, or the thing that he's really dealing with apart from his schizophrenia, is that obedience to authority kind of thing. They're asking him to do something that he feels fundamentally against, because of his family. And they're right. So he's like being told to testify for his brother. And, I feel like a lot of his life feels this way. Like they're telling him, they commit him. Like there's very much this authority figure, especially because they appear to be a well-to-do family. So I think that it's just really a callback to that. Like, how far will he go? based on what his authority is telling him.
Okay. I like that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Something else that I wrote down, we talked a little bit when we were talking about Glow about watching good actors act badly. Mm-hmm. But so there were the skits with Justin Theroux's doctor, all of those videos, those were just like such a delight to watch. A good actor being this doctor who cannot act doing these little commercial skits. And that was another just delightful little detail that I very much appreciated.
The relationship that I was most like, WTF about it was Justin Theroux and Sally Field, like the mother son thing that was happening there was very strange. I don't know, like
I definitely could have done without the kiss on the mouth.
Right.
we could have left that out and I'd have been just fine.
Yes, that's mostly what I was thinking about.
I enjoyed that how that relationship functioned within the larger story. Again, just because so many of these things are about kind of storytelling, and like that relationship was very clearly there as this is a classic complicated mother or mother son relationship, whatever, all of that kind of stuff. And the way in which you have Sally Field, this therapist, talking about that complicated relationship. I don't know. I enjoyed that. In particular, her, after she has been brought up to speed on the situation, like when she first gets to the lab, they kind of explain everything to her before they put her in. And she's just like, just so we're clear, like you created a robot to modeled after your mother.
Stop talking to me.
Because you made this when you made this robot, and then you called me in to fix your robot that you modeled after me. But like therapy's garbage. Garbage, right? Like that's your whole idea, your whole worldview is the therapy's crap. So, okay, cool.
Which, to be fair, like she did some really weird, like she had her own grieving moment, I guess, when James was growing up and she didn't deal with that well. But I think, you know, he obviously took that in a way where he was like, therapy's stupid because my mom is a therapist and she messed up one time or whatever it was. but I think, in the larger context of like, hey guys, grief is hard on everybody. Like, I understand where that whole storyline was coming. And I found it interesting too that at the end, it was just, they were like, he was like, want to have lunch sometime? And she's like, actually, I'm going out of the country for a long time. Bye. And it was like, they didn't really try to like force that, just the same way they didn't really try to force like a romance on Annie and Owen. There was like, Sylvia had said like intimacy there, but like they never even kissed. Like it wasn't a very super forced thing. So I appreciated that they went in both of those directions and didn't like, I don't know, jam in a happy ending there.
And even when Annie and Owen were married in one of their like lives with children, it still didn't feel like, it felt very tender. It always felt like they are family in the sense that here are two people who are here to care for each other and take care of each other and love each other. But it just always characterized what I felt was the strongest parts of their relationship, even if maybe as appearing in another way, because science is weird and brains are weird.
I had a lot of moments while watching this that I thought, this reminds me of something else. And I think that was
on purpose
because of those like genre callbacks that we were talking about. Also, Sylvia mentioned like the Walt Disney or the Epcot connection. I kept thinking of Dharma from Lost, like because it had that retro feel of science or whatnot. Like every time I saw like the labs or whatever, I was like, oh, this is so Dharma.
There are a lot of like referential moments like that. I mean, it is deliberately filmed and constructed as a series of like, and now we're going to make a movie that's like this, is basically like what each episode is in to varying degrees, but still being situated. The whole thing, just the whole premise has a very Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind vibe to it, but infinitely weirder.
What did you guys think about, because this was something that struck me, particularly as made as a TV show as opposed to as a film, was the amount of gore
The like almost like depersonalization of bodies, like as soon as someone was dead, it, like they, even the way that they depicted, you know, guts was so like removed, like was impersonal is what it felt like. And so I'm just curious what you guys thought about the use of like gore, because I do feel like it was intentional and it felt very much for me like it made me feel impersonal a little bit about the people who were being harmed, because it was never someone that was that I cared about, really. But it sound not it didn't feel gratuitous, but it felt like there was a lot of it. And that was surprising to me.
I was definitely surprised by it too. I had thought about it when you mentioned the blue alien guts splattering, because as soon as you said that, I was like, there were a couple like blood and gut splatters like throughout the whole thing. And one moment where when he's one of the like mafia guys is using a drill that I had to fast forward. Like I just skipped, skipped a little. I don't know what I missed or if it ever even showed anything, but I
It showed a lot. You made the right choice. It was pretty gruesome. That was the only bit of gory stuff that I didn't like fast forward through it, but I also didn't watch it. Like I like held up my hand, but I like held up my hand thinking like, okay, we're going to do this real quick and then it's going to be over. But I'm just like sitting like, okay, are we done
any
now?
Any second now. Yeah.
No, it was, that one was long because he's naming parts of the brain as he's drilling into the,
I'm not usually like squeamish about guts and stuff. Like there was one, somebody got like blasted open and there was like guts everywhere. Like I'm not squeamish about that, but torture cannot. So as soon as he was like, I got my drill, I was like, really? I got a fast forward button. Boop. And then I just like skipped over the entire thing.
Probably a good choice.
Yeah, I support that. That choice. I mentioned Crash Course Film earlier, and I am bringing it up now again because Cary Fukunaga, who directed this, also directed a movie that was in the Crash Course Film criticism, which I have to bring up because I have not actually seen this movie. I didn't see most of the movies that we did in film criticism, but I listened. I enjoyed listening to these films be discussed, much like this podcast, I guess. So he also directed Beasts of No Nation, which is about, basically it's about child soldiers, like a very like gritty, okay, from what I know of the film that I haven't seen, is that it's like a very gritty and brutal. And actually in the film criticism episode, there's a clip of like, we used a clip from the movie where the like two of the child soldiers are like macheteing a man to death. The use of like blood and gore was interesting, having that prior context for this director and then seeing it appear so frequently here was also very interesting.
Fascinating that you say that. Now this makes a lot more sense as to why people were like, oh, this is clever, because I did not know that. One of the porn videos is called Beasts of Urination. Which also to me is funny for like later context of the not funny, but like of that is seemingly like if you were maybe paying attention or thought about it, that it is definitely calling forward to the incident that happened with Jed and his proclivities to urine.
I'm looking over his like director credits, and the only thing I've seen is the 2011 Jane Eyre.
Which probably is why there's Jane Derriere. Was the other porn film. So that's probably
all these
porn puns of his films. That's great. Films.
You know, Jane Eyre is angsty and dark as it is, but that movie was also very beautiful, very angsty and very dark. So
The more you know.
I know.
The more you know.
Yeah, I wish this was another thing too. Like I brought up Beasts of No Nation, but as soon as I started talking, I was like, I don't really have anywhere that I'm going with this. I just like, this is another one of those things that I wish that I had, I don't know, better language. We were talking about beforehand too. This is every now and then when we're going into doing a podcast episode, we're like, yeah, we should ask somebody who like knows a lot about X, whatever, like beforehand. But because we knew so little about this thing, it was only afterwards that we were like, oh yeah, like a you know, somebody who know, you know, like Nick or somebody with that sort of film vocabulary would have been cool to have, whatever.
Well, I don't know. It's fascinating.
but I've enjoyed trying to talk through this with my two friends.
This is definitely one. I mean, because we did this in such a tight turnaround. This wasn't even like we put it off, so we had to binge it. Like we planned it this way. But this is definitely one that, as I was preparing, I was like, this is one, something that I would 100% rewatch, and two, something I want to sit with. Like, I just want to, I feel like if we recorded this episode like in 2 weeks, I would have other things to like kind of connect and put together. And I think it's part of it is that it has like those big moments. Part of it is that it's a whole series based around you kind of watching and asking yourself, what is going on? So it's like
it's like built for you to discuss it too, though, which is interesting as a, you know, Netflix show, sort of notoriously the binge content. And which we did because it just came out and we're recording this now. But it does feel like something that would be better if you were watching it a little bit slower or like with people. So Sylvia is one of my like group of friends. We have on several occasions just sort of gathered a group of friends and like we just spend a whole day binge watching a season of something. This is something that would be prime for that kind of experience. Like to
we should do that.
I want to spend a day just like with my friends watching the show and like stopping after each episode to be like, so that just happened, right?
And in classic Sylvia and Nicole fashion, we'll have already seen it and be enjoying just as much watching our friends' reactions to things.
We can lead the discussions. Right. Like, okay, so what do you think that elf meant?
Like, let's talk about her ears.
And on that note, we are going to wrap this bizarre episode up. Thank you to Sylvia for joining us and to all of you for listening. If you are enjoying this podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you considered supporting us on Patreon, where we've got some bonus content and polls to vote on future podcast media. You can find out more about that at patreon.com/snarksquad. We would love to hear all of your thoughts about this episode. You can find a post dedicated to this episode as well as any show notes at snarksquad.com, or you can find us on Twitter at snark_squad. I am at Sweeney Says.
You can find me at My Name Is Marines.
And you can find me at Sylvia, S-I-L-V-I-A, 717.
Thank you, as always, to Stefan Shin for the delightful theme music that is playing us out right now. And we will be back again next week to discuss George R.R. Martin's A Storm of Swords. Bye.
Bye. Bye.